This is CliffCentral.com.
Jordan Peterson, congratulations on your book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. And welcome to CliffCentral.com, not for the first time.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Dr. Jordan Peterson is a professor at the University of Toronto. He's a clinical psychologist, author of this book I've just mentioned, 12 Rules for Life. He was born in 1962, has grown up in Canada, and came to some acclaim and came to my knowledge when he started making a noise and some controversy around the pronouns, gender pronouns, that were forced by law into Canadian society and into common usage, although I don't think they've picked up much common usage. The book, though, to start there, is about how you can improve your life, about how you can live better, how you can find meaning. And Dr. Peterson, there are probably a lot of young people who would benefit from this book.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, I think that young people, I think that our culture took a bad turn in some ways in the 1960s when it became accepted wisdom that the appropriate pattern of action for young people who were concerned about making things better was to transform themselves into social or political activists and to follow an ideological route. And I think that's an extraordinarily bad idea. I think it's arrogant, first of all, because it's very, very hard to change complex social systems for the better. Most of the time when you change them, especially when you don't know what you're doing, you make them worse. And the problems that large social systems have are extraordinarily complex and intractable. And when you're 18, 19, 20, you don't know anything about the world yet. You haven't made your contribution yet. You haven't matured. You haven't developed a career. You haven't finished your education. You haven't repaid society for nurturing you. You don't know anything about history or literature or art or philosophy or politics or economics or the way complex systems work. And you have enough to do to put your own house in order. And that's not a trivial thing. It's a very complicated thing, and it's a very worthwhile thing, and it's a meaningful thing. And that's much more appropriate place to start. And so that's at least in part what 12 Rules for Life is about.
Professor, there are probably a lot of things that you and I will agree about. There's this strange thing that's happening in society where an almost cultural Marxism has started to seep into particularly the universities and places where a lot of young people who don't read history books tend to congregate. I wonder if you have any guiding principles when it comes to morality. I suspect you may have a bent towards the origin being religious. I suppose that that's as good an argument as to say that it's at the center of humanitarianism. But what do you think about having a moral code, a value system?
Well, in moral ideas, you know, people always think of moral ideas as a terrible form of restriction. That's another part of the modern malaise. But that's not really the case, because a moral system orders the world for you. And there's two advantages to that. The first is that because you know what to do, you're nowhere near as anxious, and then you're not frustrated and disappointed and guilty and ashamed and nihilistic and hopeless and all of those things. So it provides you with a structure, like the walls of your house provide you with protection from the elements. But even more importantly is that it provides you with something to aim up at. And it's clearly the case, and I outline this a fair bit in 12 Rules for Life, that most of the positive emotion that people feel, and that would be the kind of positive emotion that produces the sense of positive engagement in life, is a consequence of aiming at something good and then moving towards it. Not accomplishing it, not getting there, but moving towards it. And that technically, that's the psychomotor exploratory system that's activated when you're engaged in that kind of endeavor. And it's also the system that drugs like cocaine and amphetamines and so forth, the drugs of abuse that people like to take, activate. And you need a strict moral system because it gives you something to aim at, and giving you something to aim at is what produces the positive meaning in life that offsets all the terror and catastrophe and tragedy. And so the fact that we are losing touch, let's say, with the wisdom of our past is an absolute catastrophe, because it leaves people disoriented and without aim. And life isn't bearable if you're disoriented and without aim. the catastrophe of life comes welling in on you, and people become anxious and depressed and nihilistic, and then things really get bad, because enough nihilism and hopelessness, you start to get cruel and vicious and vindictive. And you see that all the time with the school shooters in the United States. You know, that epidemic of violence that's a consequence of rebellion and vengefulness that's motivated by nihilism and hopelessness. It's really not good. These are very serious problems. And so I knew that this, I knew these things were a problem when I started writing back in the 1980s about the ideological conflict that was tearing the world apart at that point, which was really the democratic capitalist free market systems versus the Stalinist, Maoist, communist systems. And I was trying to lay out a third, I was trying to lay out a path that wasn't ideological between those two, let's say, more accurately to lay out why the West was correct in its emphasis on individual responsibility and the sovereignty of the individual, which is something we just can't lose. Like, it's such a, it's so unlikely that we got that right. You know, most cultures are, most societies are run by collectivist thugs. And in the West, at least we know that's wrong, that the individual should be sovereign, and that's individual responsibility, not freedom and impulsivity. So yeah, I knew there was something wrong. There's definitely something wrong.
What is wrong with collectivism? Why do so many people think that the left is a good place to find new ideas when so many of the ideas are discredited, where there's so many people who disagree with the basic precept? I mean, what's wrong with this, and who's to blame?
I think you can lay this at the feet of the universities. I really believe that, as much as I hate to say it, because the universities have been the nesting place, let's say, of the postmodern neo-Marxists ever since the 1970s, well, and before that to some degree. I mean, it was a little bit more understandable in the 60s when the civil rights struggle was occurring in the United States, and, you know, the society was torn apart by the war between communism and the West. But now, and for the last 30 years, the universities, especially the humanities and a fair bit of the social sciences, have turned radically towards the left. And a huge proportion of academics, it's about 1 in 5, identify as Marxists, which, as far as I'm concerned, is utterly reprehensible, utterly reprehensible. You can't identify as a Nazi, but it's okay to identify with one of the most murderous ideologies that have ever plagued mankind. And that can be a badge of pride and honor. And then students are taught that, you know, the West is an oppressive capitalist patriarchy hell-bent on domination. It's basically racist in its fundamental substructure, and we're destroying the planet and the economy along with human relationships. And all of that is patently false. So the universities have a huge debt on their, a huge debt on their conscience, and they haven't straightened out at all at the moment, as far as I can tell.
So, Dr. Peterson, what is the left? Let's explain this, because there are probably many people who will enter this discussion going, it sounds like these guys have got a bug up their ass about this thing. What is the left, and how do you see their particular outlook on humanity, on society, on structural engineering, in terms of societal engineering? How do you see those things in a leftist context?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I mean, the first thing we might want to lay out is why there needs to be a left wing at all. And there's a real reason for that. There's a book that your viewers and your watchers might be interested in called The Great Leveler by Walter Scheidel. It's a new book. And I really like it. It's an empirical study of inequality. And it's actually a rather terrifying book, because inequality, and I write about this in Rule 1 in my and throughout 12 Rules for Life, inequality is a really big problem. There's a statement in the New Testament, to those who have everything, more will be given, and from those who have nothing, everything will be taken. And it's really, it's called the Matthew Principle by economists. And the principle is that the spoils tend to disproportionately benefit a small minority. Now, that minority changes quite rapidly, but a minority gets produces and acquires most goods. It doesn't matter what the goods are. And people have a proclivity to stack up at zero, which is a very bad thing, because it destabilizes societies and makes them violent. Now, capitalism, the Marxists like to lay inequality at the feet of capitalism. And that's wrong. It's not just a little bit wrong. It's unbelievably wrong, because inequality characterizes every human society that's ever been studied, and also animal societies as well, going back as far down the evolutionary pathway as you can stretch. So inequality is, and this is why I like Shadell's book too, because he does a couple of things. He does a historical analysis of inequality and shows that it was rampant long before capitalist institutions were formulated. And also does an empirical analysis showing that measures of inequality don't move with the polarity of governments. So you might say, well, if you looked at all the right-wing governments and all the left-wing governments that ever have been, was inequality lessened on the left? And the answer to that is no. And Shadell concludes from that we don't know how politically, economically, sociologically, or psychologically, we don't know how to combat the proclivity towards inequality. He identified four factors that reduce inequality, and none of them are the sorts of things you would hope to have happen. War, revolution, and epidemics were three of them. And the fourth one is in the same category. So catastrophes produce leveling, but no intelligent, no intelligent sociological transformations appear to put much of a dent in it. So look, so the problem is inequality, let's say. And equality looks unfair on the surface. Inequality is the default setting in nature. That's exactly right. Okay, and so what's the problem with that? Well, it produces a fair bit of obvious suffering. You know, like nobody's happy walking down the street seeing homeless people who are suffering. It's hard on you psychologically. It's hard on the stability of the society. Nobody likes the fact that there are people suffering and in poverty. And so that motivates a fair bit of compassion, the sort of genuine compassion that drives the genuinely caring people on the left. Okay, so there's going to be a left, because the left always is trying to stand up for the people who stack up at zero on whatever the distribution happens to be. And fair enough, you know, like the working class needs a voice, needs a political voice, let's say. And so, but the problem is that all the motives on the left are far from pure, because, you know, it's not like all the saints stack up on the left and all the sinners stack up on the right. That isn't how it works. And so the left also tends to become pathologized by a hatred of the successful rather than by compassion for the poor.
What are the origins of this kind of thinking?
Well, okay, so let's go back to 1918, to the time of the Russian Revolution. And let's say, while there was a lot of inequality in society and Europe was in shambles after World War I and the monarchical systems had fallen apart and there was a cry for democracy and freedom and for egalitarianism, for redistribution of power and wealth. And you can understand that partly because Europe was in shambles and partly because of the problems of inequality, which were made even more blatant in some ways by the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you can read George Orwell's Road to Wagon Pier if you want to learn about how coal miners lived in the 1930s. It was pretty damn brutal. So people had every reason, I would say, to hope that a more egalitarian state that was more peaceful and more universal could be brought into being. And you might say, well, to some degree, those positive motivations drove the Russian Revolution. But that was 100 years ago. Okay, now it's 100 years later. Well, we've watched what happens when Marxist presuppositions were put into practice. And what happens inevitably is that the corpses start to stack up in the millions. And that's to say nothing of just general persecution. This is outright death. I mean, we don't know how many people were killed in the Soviet Union. The estimates range from 20 to 60 million. But we can call them uncountable, and that's just fine. And in Maoist China, it might have been 100 million, and it was 6 million in Cambodia. And you might say, well, that's not real communism, which is what people do say who are the apologists. But look, the principles were put into place in extraordinarily diverse societies by very different people, and the results were always the same. And you can see the same thing happening now. Well, you can see the same thing happening in Venezuela, which is an absolute catastrophe. And so there's no excuse to be a Marxist anymore. the evidence is in. And if that's not enough evidence for you, then I would say you should work on your, if the 100 million corpses aren't enough evidence for you, you should really sit down and think just what it would take to demonstrate to you that that particular approach to the world is wrong. Now, having said that, I understand that inequality is a problem, but it's a far deeper problem than the bloody Marxists have any comprehension of.
Why does this kind of thinking have such fertile ground in the minds of young people?
Well, I think young people do have what Jean Piaget, the developmental psychologist, called a kind of a messianic urge in their late adolescence. They want to go out and early adulthood. Many of them want to go out and do good things in the world. And that's a salutary impulse. But then they're taught and enticed, I would say, by ideologues into taking the easy way forward. And the easy way forward is to not grapple with the difficulties of establishing, of becoming genuinely educated, of establishing a genuine individual career, a family, commitments, responsibilities, all of that, growing yourself into a mature person who has enough wherewithal to actually contend with the problems of the world. The activist types offer them a shortcut. They say, well, all the problems of the world can be laid at the feet of other people. Take your pick. Capitalists, rich people, powerful people, white men, the patriarchy, the colonialists, like, have it. It doesn't matter, but some group of oppressors.
They don't want to take personal responsibility for the situation they find themselves in or any improvement to that situation.
That's right. It's not. It's someone else. It's someone else, and you should go stop them. It's like, well, that's a quick route to unearned power. That's a big part of it. It allows you to circumvent your personal responsibility, and it allows you to do all that while putting forward the pretense that you're acting in a positive way in the world. So it also enables you not to identify your own dark motivations. It's like, what makes you so sure you care for the poor and you just don't hate the rich? Like, what makes you the saint? Exactly. You're not. You're not. You have a dark side just like everybody else, and that dark side is a lot darker than you think. And that's true even when you're compassionate.
A lot of your articles that you've written, a lot of the papers that you've delivered and the YouTube videos that you've done feature the propensity in ordinary humans for evil, the ability for most of us to be able to do the most depraved and horrible things. And you call up a number of examples. You know, a lot of people seem to think that in the worst of circumstances, they would behave in an admirable way. Is this true?
The it's almost certain that they would have from a statistical perspective. I mean, everybody looks at Nazi Germany and thinks that they're going to be Oscar Schindler or the people who took in Anne Frank. It's like, no, you're not. People are very timid. They're very timid. They won't stand forward with and they'll crumble under a lot less pressure than was able to be applied in Nazi Germany. That's for sure. And the idea that you'd be a hero under those conditions is, well, it's highly improbable. It's highly improbable. So you have to look and understand how it is that you might come to participate in such brutal actions and to also to take responsibility for that. And you understand that in part by looking at your own life and your own shortcomings and all the things, all the ways that you fall short of the ideal and all the ways that you take little bits of petty revenge on the people around you and all the resentments you nurse for the conditions of your existence and all the lies you tell. And like, people have a very bad dark side. There's no doubt about it. Now, most of the time we can act reasonably civilly in public, although it's not so clear we do that in the confines of our private families. So, but better to straighten yourself out. It's a very difficult thing to do, but it's a better thing to do.
There are a lot of people who will take a look at families, for example, and see that there are single-headed households, single-parent-headed households, and that often that's the woman who takes care of the family. And while she's brave, and while that's a very difficult and not necessarily ideal situation, you go one step further and say that this is actually going to set the child back. It's a tremendous disadvantage to be raised by just one parent, particularly in youth.
No, look, the empirical data on that's absolutely clear. Like, this is another one of those situations where there's no debate among serious social scientists. It's way better to have two parents. period. And it's obvious why. I mean, it's obvious. Having little kids is a full-time job. And so if you're a single mother, first of all, the probability that you're going to descend into something approximating poverty is quite high, even if you start out in the middle class. Second, the time demands on you are just beyond anybody's ability to tolerate. You have your 30 or 40 hours a week of childcare if you have young children, even if you just have one child. And then you have your job. It's like you don't get to have a life outside of that. And it's too much of a burden. That doesn't mean there aren't single parents who are struggling admirably and who do a credible job. But as social policy, the idea that all families are equal is an insane idea. It's not supported in the least by the relevant literature. So kids from intact families, kids from families where there are two parents, do better on almost all measures, and a lot better. So we don't need to debate this. The data are already in.
Some people would say that you're discriminating.
Well, I am discriminating. I am discriminating. You know, I'm saying that
you're discriminating unfairly.
Right, of course. Well, you know, it depends on whose side are you on. Are you on the side of the poor, embattled single mother, and fair enough, or are you on the side of the children? It's like children, once there are children in the picture, they're the ones that count, which is also something for people to give some consideration to when they get married. It's like once you have kids, it's not about you anymore. You're secondary. It's about the kids. And the kids need two parents. And that's that. And so we can struggle mightily against the responsibility that imposes all we want. But, and I'm also not saying that people don't make mistakes. And I'm also not saying that single parents in some situations can't do a better job than dual parents. But on average, it's clearly not the case. And the reason that we rebel against these ideas is there's a couple of them. With the Kathy Newman interview, she couldn't accept the idea that the reasons for the gender pay gap, such as it is, are complex and multivariate, which they clearly are. So here's a bunch of reasons why men make more money than women. First of all, they work longer hours. If you work 14% more hours, you make something like 40% more money. The extra work has a disproportionate effect. Men take more dangerous jobs. They're more likely to work outside. They're more likely to move. They're more likely to move into the STEM, move physically. They're more likely to take jobs in the STEM professions, which pay higher. And you might say, well, that's because the STEM professions are prejudiced against women. It's like, wrong. That's not true. What happens is that as societies become more egalitarian, women are less likely to go into the STEM fields. And that's not pseudoscience. That's rock solid social science. And no one was happy about its discovery. So you can't blame it on the bias of the researchers. And so Kathy Newman couldn't accept the multivariate explanation for the pay gap, because she likes to believe that Western society is a corrupt patriarchal institution hell-bent on the domination of women. And that's one of her key facts to support that supposition. And it's simply not true. That isn't what Western society is. It's the most cooperative society that's ever existed. And it's elevated the status of women far beyond the status they've had in any other culture ever throughout history. So, and the idea...
You're famously quoted as having researched lobsters.
Yep.
And having discovered that even lobsters are prone and predisposed to creating hierarchies.
Yep.
Do you think humans, and particularly privileged humans in positions in the hierarchy which are enviable, are likely to give those positions up?
Well, the idea that people will try to preserve their position in a hierarchy is obviously true. But having said that, and so people will defend their position in a hierarchy, and everyone does that. I don't care who they are. But it's a question of inertia, and also sometimes it's a question of deserving the position, and sometimes it's a question of the pain of having to abandon it. There's lots of reasons why people will try to preserve and maintain a structure, and some of those aren't seemly reasons. So we could easily say, along with the postmodernists, that every human organization has a tilt towards tyranny that has to be managed. It's like, that's an archetypal truth. That's the evil king. That's the tyrant. But to paint our whole society as a tyranny means that, well, first of all, it means that you're unbelievably historically ignorant. If you think Western democracies are tyrannies, you should go visit a tyranny for a while. right? Even in your imagination. That doesn't mean our societies are perfect. And but there's also so much about that that's resentful and bitter and wrong. Like, I've known many, many very, very competent and powerful people in academia, in the media, in business, in all sorts of domains, entrepreneurs, like dozens of them, maybe even hundreds of them now. And I can say without exception that except for the tiny minority of them who had a personality disorder, some characterological problem, which is very rare among successful people, by the way, they were all thrilled to help other people climb the ladder. One of the positive pleasures they took was to find young people and mentor them. It's one of the huge pleasures of occupying a position of, let's say, authority and competence, is you get to find young people who want to have a shot at the world and you can open doors for them. And you might think, well, that's all naive and I live in a Pollyanna world. Well, I can tell you, first of all, I'm not naive and I don't bloody well live in a Pollyanna world. And I've seen this, I saw it at Harvard with the professors there. I've seen it with the entrepreneurs that I've worked with and the lawyers. It's like, and my patients as well, and the people that I've consulted with. It's like, it's not like there is an evil tyrant who's keeping everyone down. That doesn't mean that people aren't kept down, but there's lots of reasons for that. And they're complicated reasons.
One of the things that got you a lot of attention and created enormous controversy on the internet was the issue around Bill C-16 in Canada and the issue of having to use, being forced by law to use certain pronouns, which led to all kinds of complications in public institutions, and where if you didn't use those pronouns, you would be in contravention of the law. You stood up and said, no, you cannot regulate my speech. How did that go?
Yeah, well, we're required also by law in Canada because that Bill C-16 passed. And the defenders of the bill say, well, it doesn't do what Dr. Peterson described it doing, and that's completely wrong. And the evidence for that's clear. I mean, we had a huge scandal in Canada at a university called Wilfrid Laurier, where a teaching assistant named Lindsay Shepherd was pilloried by her professors and by an administrator hired for that purpose because she dared to show 5 minutes of a video from a Canadian public television station that's very well regarded and very centrist. She dared to show it to one of her classes in a neutral manner. It was the biggest scandal that ever hit a Canadian university. And it was like she was subjected to a Maoist inquisition. And so the legislation is every bit as reprehensible as I described it, and perhaps more so. And that sort of legislation is spreading like mad across the Western world, and it's seriously not a good thing. This victimization status is, well, once you divide the world into oppressed and oppressor, and then add race and ethnicity and gender to that already toxic brew, then you give people within that framework status points, let's say, for multiplying their dimensions of victimization. And that means that people who are perfectly willing to use their suffering as a weapon, let's say, are emboldened to precisely do so. It's a very bad idea. I did some work with a graduate student of mine, a very smart girl who had toured the mass grave sites in the former Yugoslavia and was there for the breakup of the country. And we wrote a paper on the precursors to genocide. And one of the precursors to genocide is an enhanced sense of victimization on the part of the people who ultimately carry out the genocide. So victimization, look, life is hard. People have tragic lives. You could say in some sense that we're all victims of our own fragility and mortality and even our own proclivity for evil, none of which you can necessarily directly lay at the feet of any of us as individuals. But to play your life out as if you're a victim and that you're being oppressed and that life is unfair and that you need to find a persecutor to torment, that just makes everything way, way, way worse. It'll make you worse, first of all, miserable and bitter, and then it'll make you dangerous, and then it'll destabilize your society. It's an unbelievably bad idea, and this is what we're feeding to young people. It's not good.
In the book, you found pretty easy things for people to start doing. Things like stand up straight and put your shoulders back.
Well, I tried to, well, that's the thing. I tried to pick rules that I wouldn't call them banal exactly, but they have an element of normal day-to-dayness about them, you know? And then I wanted to go deep, deep down to show why those are conventions. And, you know, to stand up straight with your shoulders back, well, there's a physical element to that because it it's an injunction to a literal behavioral transformation. It's like, pay attention and notice how you're standing and stand up straight. Okay, well, why? Well, that starts a cascade of beneficial sociological and psychobiological processes. But then there's a metaphorical reason too, which is that life comes at you like a never-ending catastrophe. I mean, it's opportune as well, but it's just confronting you constantly, your own fragility and the catastrophe of the world. And the question is, how do you withstand that? And the answer is voluntarily, with your shoulders back and yourself exposed to the world. That's the courageous stance of confrontation. And that's your best bet. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily always going to prevail. It doesn't mean that at all, but there isn't a better strategy than to take that on voluntarily. And the thing about taking it on voluntarily, see, this is the message, the deep symbolic message that lies at the bottom of, let's say, at the bottom of Christianity, and in some sense, because of that, at the bottom of the West. The reason that Christ is a symbolic figure, regardless of what you think about this religiously, we can speak about it only psychologically, is because Christ represents the individual who's willing to accept betrayal and a painful death as the price for existence. Can you accept that? Well, you can't just say yes. I mean, that's a hard thing to accept, man. This is no joke. But what are you going to do? You're going to whine about it and get embittered and treat yourself as a victim and take revenge against the world? Or are you going to stand forth and try to do something positive? Like, those are your options.
When I look at what you've done and the output of all of your work, I find myself confused. And if I had to try and put myself in the position of being a clinical psychologist like you are, and you were my patient, I would say, Jordan Peterson is this very interesting combination of both a tremendously optimistic person who seems to believe in humanity, on the one hand, and on the other hand, someone who is very skeptical about the ability for humans to do anything, about a life which is inherently full of suffering. And that's pessimistic. So I find myself asking, which are you?
That's a great observation. That's a great observation. Look, this is how I look at it. And this is, I think, why my lectures and this book have received the attention they've received. There's a lot of reasons, but this is certainly one of them. Look, everybody knows what life is like. Everybody knows that life is a slaughterhouse, and that history is a nightmare, and that we're all steeped in blood up to our necks. Everyone knows that, and everyone knows that human beings have an unbelievable proclivity for malevolence and destruction. We all know that. Okay, so then I make that very clear in my talks and in my book, and you might say, well, God, how could you be any more pessimistic than that? And right, I don't think you can be, but, and this is the important thing, is that as the darkness becomes darker, because you're willing to peer into it, the light becomes clearer. You can see your way through. If you know how terrible things are, then you know what to avoid. And that's a huge start. And so I would say I am as pessimistic a person as you could possibly encounter. But I'm also optimistic because I do believe, and this is after very careful consideration, I believe that the human spirit is up to the task. I believe that despite the fact that life is a brutal tragedy in many ways and that malevolence is real, I believe that the human spirit is stronger than the darkness. And I say that with reservation, knowing to some degree at least the depth of the darkness. And so I can say to people, look, there's way more to you than you think. There's way more to you than you think. And so if you face the things that are terrible and evil, then you can triumph over them. And that's really something. People think, oh my God, he's not painting a rosy picture of existence. So it's not snake oil here. You know what I mean? It's not an easy fix. But having said that things are dark, it's still possible to say that they could be lighter. And I think that that's real.
In much of your writing, you take a very important focus and place it on truth. You seem to believe, and I think that this is admirable, that truth matters. Now, in a world of Donald Trump and of Stalin and of people who have lied to us for pretty much the whole of human history, and particularly these are people in leadership positions, explain to me why truth is so important to you.
Well, the first thing I would say about that is that I spent a lot of time trying to understand totalitarian atrocity, and the people that I've read who I admired the most, people like Primo Levi and Viktor Frankl and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, among them, and Dostoevsky for that matter, and Solzhenitsyn as well, made a very, very strong case that it was the individual proclivity to falsify his or her own experience that allowed the totalitarian brutality of the state to continue. So there's a direct relationship between individual morality and tyranny, partly because, well, as tyranny begins to be imposed on you, you have to drive yourself through a series of convoluted lies in order to accept it. And so if you refuse to lie, then tyrants have a much harder time getting their hands around your neck. And so you need to refuse to lie just to keep tyranny at bay. But it's more than that. It's like, well, if you're deceiving, if you're engaged in deception, who in the world do you think you're fooling? Are you fooling yourself? Well, that's not a good idea, because the more you fool yourself, the more you fill yourself with information that isn't an accurate reflection of the world, the more you act on that information, and the worse your end is going to be. And then if you're trying to fool other people, it's like, well, how long do you think that's going to work for? It's not like people aren't tracking your reputation. And are you trying to fool reality? It's like, well, good luck with that. There's reality. There's a lot of reality. There isn't that much of you. And you're just not going to get anywhere with it. Now, what people do is they deceive and they gain in the short term. And they make themselves willfully blind to the medium and the long term. And so they think, well, I got away with that. It's like, well, no, you didn't. It's just that the other shoe hasn't dropped. And it might take 10 years. And by then you may have forgotten why it happens. But you don't bend the fabric of reality without it snapping back and taking you out, ever. I've never seen anyone in my clinical practice ever get away with anything, ever. It's terrifying. But how could it be otherwise? How do we believe that we can bend the fabric of reality and that will stand? That isn't how it works. Reality, it doesn't succumb to your machinations. So you might say, well, you know, here's crooked person X and they're rich and they're powerful and look at how they're thriving. And I would say, you're not looking close enough. Their wealth masks their corruption. Their power only provides them with a manner of manifesting their bitterness and resentment. The people around them hate and despise them for their corruption. There's nothing about it that's good. It's a rotting corpse that's covered with guilt. I mean guilt, like gold guilt. I don't mean the psychological guilt, right? And there's nothing about that that's good. It's better to go to sleep with a clear conscience. Just look at someone like Joseph Stalin near the end of his life. He didn't trust anyone. He thought everyone lied to him all the time, which was true, because everyone lied to him all the time. He thought he was surrounded by enemies, which he was. Like, he lived in hell. I mean, you think, well, he was one of the most powerful tyrants that ever lived. It's like, yeah, well, he ruled over hell. Well, you know, if that's what you want, then go for it. But my suggestion is you won't find it to your liking when you get there. It's better to serve humbly it's better to work in a diner as an honest man than to work as a tyrant of a corrupt society. And I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean, it's actually better.
You're a very eloquent and erudite man. You are able to use language effectively to communicate ideas. A lot of people get caught up in the language, and it does matter what words you use. And I remember watching an interview where you were asked questions by an interviewer who clearly had an agenda. She made it sound like you did not mean the things that you were saying and that you actually meant things that she thought you were saying or that she wanted you to say. Using the right words really matters. If you're a person who isn't as articulate as you are, is there still a way to communicate your ideas effectively, to be understood properly, to impute true meaning to a sentence?
That's a fine question. Well, I have a chapter, I think it's chapter 6, rule 6 is don't lie, or tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Well, I think the at least don't lie is a really good start. It's like, because you can watch your own speech and you can see, well, first of all, the most obvious example is, or the most obvious phenomenon, let's say, is sometimes you know that you're lying. You just know it. And so you could stop doing that. Is when you notice that you're lying, you should stop talking and you should reformulate your speech until you're not lying. And, you know, sometimes you may not know whether you're lying or not, because, like, who knows the truth? But you can at least start with the egregious sins, let's say. And then it can get more subtle. You can start to notice when you speak whether your speech has integrity. You can feel that psychophysiologically. You can tell if you're saying something, if it makes you feel like you're coming apart at the seams or you're weak. And if you pay attention to that, you can learn to say things. You can learn to stop saying things that make you weak. And, you know, even if you're not overwhelmingly verbally intelligent and fluent, let's say, so you're kind of introverted and, you know, maybe your verbal IQ isn't stellar, and so you're not as articulate as you might be, you can still have the force of character behind your words. And that's not trivial. Like, I meet people all the time, working men in particular, who aren't particularly articulate, but who are very competent at what they're doing and are very trustworthy and very skilled. And, you know, when they talk, which isn't that often, people listen. And they talk about what they understand and what they have knowledge of, and that's good enough. If everyone did that, then that would be just fine. So I don't think you need to be spectacularly articulate in order to be sufficiently articulate. And then if you want to take it beyond that, well, it's really helpful to read and to write and to become educated in the liberal sense, you know, before the post in the classic liberal sense, to educate yourself with a liberal education so that you can learn to be an effective communicator. It's extraordinarily important.
So a couple of short questions. I was perplexed by the title of this chapter and I haven't read it yet. You say that when you encounter a cat on the street, you should pet that cat. What's that all about?
Well, that rule is about my experiences with, and my experiences personally with tragedy, and also with helping my clients go through tragic circumstances in their life, my clients and my family. I mean, there are times in your life where everything piles in on you, you know, where you're dealing with, well, maybe your partner has Alzheimer's. You know, these are very, very difficult things, or you have a sick child, or your career collapses, or, you know, you're in a time of the flood, let's say, in your own personal life. You know, the first thing you have to do is narrow your time frame so that you're only dealing with the next day or sometimes even the next hour and trying to set that as right as possible. But you have to look during those periods of time where you can take a bit of a break and to see what's still beautiful about existence and what's still welcoming. You know, and I use the cat as a metaphor for that. There's a cat that lives across the street from us, a Siamese cat, who's a really nice cat and really smart. And, you know, you go outside and the cat will check you out and come over across the street and, you know, just sort of interact with you for a few minutes if you let it. And on a terrible day, that's not such a bad thing. And you have to keep your eyes open for what can nourish you when things are really dark. And that's what that chapter is about, is to open your eyes in appreciation for what you have around you, a kind of a humble appreciation if you can manage it, even when things are really dark, because maybe that'll be enough to nourish you so that you can get through the catastrophe. So that's what that's about.
It's pretty much a stop and smell the roses, but, you know, evolved to 2018 standards.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. That's exactly it.
I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on Justin Trudeau, your current prime minister, and your government in general.
I think he's appalling. Well, I think our prime minister is exactly what you would have been afraid of had you been properly afraid when he first put himself out on the scene. So this is, when Justin Trudeau ran for office, I thought, I don't have any respect for what you're doing, because you wouldn't be doing this if your father wasn't the most famous prime minister in Canada in the last 50 years. So you have a family name, Trudeau, and you're capitalizing on that. And that's, I would say, well, that shouldn't disqualify you from political office, but you should have earned your name before you dared to throw your hat in the ring. And there's no evidence whatsoever that he had earned his name. And there's certainly no evidence now. So I thought, well, I'm very suspicious of your character, because you should you should have thought very long and hard about daring to run for political office on the strength of your name alone. It's a narcissistic and juvenile thing to do, but he did it. And then I thought, okay, well, it was time for a new government in Canada. It was time for a change. And despite the fact that it was an error in judgment to run in that manner, maybe you'll be credible. But then the first thing he did, and there was no excuse for this, and it set the tone for everything else that has happened, is he formulated his cabinet and he made it 50% women, despite the fact that only 26% of the elected representatives were women. And when pressed on that, he said, well, because it's 2015, which is a facile answer. His responsibility was to go through his members of parliament and to pick the most qualified people to do the hard work necessary to do a characterological and skills analysis of every single one of those people and pick the best people, regardless of their race, creed, color, or sex, period. And he didn't do that, and Canadians gave him a free pass. And that was a very bad idea because, well, first of all, because it was an abdication of responsibility. Second, because it was kowtowing to an ideological position. And third, because he stacked his cabinet with people who were ideologues who weren't qualified. And now we're seeing the consequences of that. The last budget, for example, the whole budget, the main theme of the budget is to address the inequitable situation between men and women, which doesn't even exist. So he's twisted the whole budget to solve a fictional problem with an ideological strategy.
It sounds very similar to what's going on here, where it's all about kind of targeted demographics and putting people in a position because they're women or because they're black, not because they're competent in that necessary position. And this has real world consequences for many people in South Africa. The last 9 years have been anything but sterling for the average South African, and particularly bad for the poor. Are you very optimistic about South Africa and what kind of a future we have?
I'm very pessimistic about your country. I think you guys are in for an absolute catastrophe over the next 10 years. I hate to say that, but this last bit of legislation with regards to the farmers' lands, that's really, really, really not good.
What do you think of the stories you've read about South Africa in the news in the last little while? It seems that we have we've cracked the nod in some quite important foreign papers when it comes to this discussion about expropriation of property without compensation.
Well, I was absolutely heartbroken, I would say, when I read the news from South Africa this week. I think it's politically expedient to do what your government is doing. I think it appeals to the worst in everyone. I understand that South Africa has extremely serious social problems and that inequality in South Africa is very, very high. And it's not obvious at all what to do about that. And it's clear that it's suboptimal. But to demolish the rule of law as a precursor to solving that problem only means that it's going to get way, way, way worse before it gets better. I mean, isn't it reasonable to think of Zimbabwe as an example? Is that an unreasonable comparison?
Well, Venezuela. I mean, the same people who would implement stupid, proven policies of destruction in South Africa would probably want to use Venezuela as an example, even though it's a lamentable, demonstrable failure in every which way. It doesn't seem that there's any ability to learn the lessons of history among leaders who are hell-bent on enforcing their ideology on the populace.
Well, I think it's a catastrophe, and I can't see how South Africans can be sleeping easily in their beds these days. So,
I saw you were featured in the New York Times just this week, and I'm not really sure whether they were being complimentary and whether they thought that you were deserving of praise or whether they were critical of you. And knowing the New York Times, it was probably the latter. But what I'm amazed by is the amount of jealousy and acrimony among your fellow academics. They seem to be unhappy about the amount of attention.
Yeah, isn't that something? Well, I think they're also guilty because they've allowed the academy to deteriorate to such a tremendous degree. You know, it's funny, though. I would say on the upside, I mean, first of all, I would say that the University of Toronto has swung quite nicely behind me in a subtle manner. And I would also say that increasingly in Canada and the U.S., and this might also be true in other Western countries, there are academics coming out of the woodwork to start to make their case that they're not happy with the continued domination of the radical leftists. So, and I also do agree with you that the world is in better shape than it's ever been. You know, I've kind of changed my Twitter strategy over the last month and a half to reflect that more. I've been tweeting a lot, especially from a group called humanprogress.org, which I really like. And they're generating statistics constantly about how much has improved since the year, well, since 1990, say. And I worked for the UN for about a year, on a report on sustainable development for the Secretary General. And I spent a whole year and a half reading everything I could get my hands on ecology and sustainable development, like dozens and dozens of books. And, you know, what I concluded back then was kind of what the Human Progress Org type guys are concluding now, which is that so many things are getting better so fast that we should be out partying in the streets. It's absolutely unbelievable how quickly we're eradicating absolute poverty from the face of the world, just as one example. Now, you know, there are some things that are happening along the way that aren't so good. Like, I think we're devastating the oceans in a massively stupid manner. I really think that's the critical ecological problem. I think it supersedes global warming by a substantial margin, partly because there's also something that could immediately be done about it. But things are getting much, much better. And it would be really unfortunate if the West tore itself apart and degenerated back into mindless tribalism just at the point where, you know, India and China are no longer starving and Africa is growing faster than any other place on earth. It's Jesus. Like, how about it would be so nice for us to open our eyes and to see that and to appreciate it and to understand the role that the West and capitalism and the free markets have played in that, which is an integral role.
Dr. Jordan Peterson, thank you so much. Your book, The 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, full of really useful things that people can start implementing in their own lives right now to add meaning, to start changing the world for better, to start doing the things that you need to do in your own realm first and then letting that spill over once your cup is full. It's a terrific book. You're a great mind. I'm delighted to live in a time of Jordan Peterson, and I hope you'll continue to fill the internet and our minds with good ideas and to keep combating bad ones.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
This is CliffCentral.com.